Bem-vindo a mais um episódio do Quem Bebe por Gosto. Este episódio foi gravado também durante o Biricero 2025 e é dedicado a um dos temas mais fascinantes e desafiantes da produção de cerveja, o dry hopping. O workshop foi conduzido por Francesco Lobu, mestre cervejeiro e consultor baseado em Londres, conhecido pelo seu trabalho técnico e pelo seu olhar preciso sobre o processo de extração de aroma e sabor a partir do lúpulo. O Francesco tem passado por cervejeiras de referência no Reino Unido, como a Beavertown, e dedica-se atualmente a partilhar conhecimento com cervejeiros em toda a Europa, tanto através de formações e consultoria, como através dos conteúdos educativos que publica nas suas redes sociais, em especial no Instagram, onde o podem encontrar como Francesco_LOB. Neste workshop, ele explica de forma prática e acessível como otimizar o dry hopping, reduzindo desperdício, melhorando a eficiência e maximizando o impacto aromático, tudo com base em dados, experiência e curiosidade científica. A sessão termina com algumas perguntas do público, onde se discutem temas como o hop creep, o reaproveitamento de lúpulos e o equilíbrio entre extração e estabilidade. Se quiseres saber mais sobre o trabalho do Francesco, encontras os links para o seu LinkedIn, Instagram e website nas notas deste episódio. Fica então com o workshop completo, gravado ao vivo no Biricera 2025, Dry Hopping, Ciência, Técnica e Sabor, com Francesco Lobu. Bora lá!
Well, guys, it's going to be a very intimate talk and chat, so please chip in if you have any question while I talk, and let's make it a conversation rather than a monologue. That'll be very nice. So I want to start with a story. So when I started brewing in 2015, 2016, like, I had no idea. I mean, I knew what dry hopping was, but I had no idea how to actually, you know, do it and get the most out of it and what are the pros and cons of it and everything. And I remember circulating a tank with a pump just to get more extraction, so break the hops more and get more volume through and, you know, move it with the hope of getting, you know, banging flavor or something, you know, super fruity and strong. And then the pump blocked. So I don't know if it ever happened to you, you know, in your career, or just to witness somebody blocking a pump. It's not great. You got the hop stuck in it, and you're just like, oh my God, I was trying to get just, you know, more out of it, and it got stuck. And 10 plus years later, somebody was asking me to recirculate a tank with a pump. I would say, hell no. I mean, not because the pump can get blocked, but because what I'm going to say later, it will actually show you that, you know, there is no actual benefit on circulating through just a centrifugal pump. So, but why, as I was saying, you know, why somebody would want to circulate a tank with a pump? It's to increase, you know, optimize their extraction. So it's to get more of that flavor. And in this half an hour, 40 minutes presentation, we'll go through all the method, how to do it properly, the pros and cons, and then some extra bit at the end. So, okay. So I think when you decide to do something, especially in a brewery, everything needs to start with a why. So why do I want to optimize my dry hopping? First, it's not on the point there, but, you know, hops, it's the most expensive ingredient that you put in your beer. So on average, you're around 30 euros a kilo. It's a lot of money. So you want to get the most out of it. And then, you know, you want to maximize your aroma and flavor, because, you know, otherwise, why are you adding hops? Because you want to get that nice aroma and, you know, layers of flavors. And then you want to optimize it, because, you know, sometimes adding more hops is not the answer. And then you need to adjust to save on your yield and, you know, reduce your losses. So that's why it needs to be optimized, because it's not just about adding the hops in and hope for the best. And then you want to optimize because you want to avoid to actually get off flavors from it, from, you know, the interaction of hops and yeast. So everything, you know, it's science, so everything needs to be calculated, like, as best, you know, as best as possible. And you want to streamline your tank time, because I think it's logic. You're thinking, look, if I leave these hops inside my tank for longer, I will get more aroma out of it. You know, it makes sense. like it doesn't really make sense in brewing, like, you know, leaving it for 4 or 5 days doesn't make it more powerful than if you leave it 24 or 48 hours. Then depends what your dry hopping method. And I speak with a lot of brewers and some clients as well, and some of them are saying, you know, we need to get a couple of more tanks because we are not meeting we don't have enough capacity. And then you go through the process and you realize, well, dry hopping doesn't need to last 5 days, 4 days. That saves you, and that gives you that extra capacity to actually, you know, meet the demand of the market. So dry hopping approaches. So those are two pictures, like are part of the memorabilia. So there are two ways. There is a dynamic, which has many ways of doing it, and there is a static one. On the dynamic one, that was on the Beavertown old brewery cellar. We were doing a dry hopping with a hopnik, and as you can see, it's a good piece of equipment. So you have a connection on the top, and then you're literally collecting the beer from the bottom. So you're creating a circulation. And then you have this imaginal mini tank. You're literally adding the hops in it, purging it, and creating this, you know, flow. And then with a vacuum, it just sucks all the pellets in. And in the middle here, you can see it, there is a macerator. So the hops that goes through, they get, you know, grinded, and then they go into the tank. They circulate for half an hour, and your dry hopping is done. But in order to do that, like, you know, you need two people to do it, because, you know, got two hands, not very long. You can't open both valves, so the risk of blocking it, you know, it's up here. So I remember the first time when I was getting trained on it, I was like, oh my God, I need to look at the pressure of the tank, the pressure of the little tank, the flow, and so many things to remember that then, you know, then become automatic. But it can be stressful, but it's actually really fun. Then we have a static one. That's clearly me, a little bit younger than now, on top of a 120 hectares tank, like we were climbing with a scissor lift. And quite dangerous, I wouldn't do it these days again. And just opening and, you know, doing your action, which can be, you know, putting the hops in or adding finings or whatever you are trying to add into your tank. So dynamic dry hopping. So there are many ways of doing it. And I appreciate that every brewery is different. You know, there are so many things that change. The beer that you make, the geometry of your tank, how much money you want to spend on a dry hopping device, and how you dry hop. There are brewers that dry hop at cast out when they pitch the yeast, somebody halfway, somebody at the end, somebody else after the centrifuge. So there are so many ways. So I don't feel like this is the way of doing a dry hopping. There are many ways. This one are the one I experienced, and I want to talk about it. And I think they are really interesting because we got the hopnik we already talked through, is the one in the picture before. We got the hop gun. So I saw so many hop gun hanging around in breweries. Because when they came out, everyone like, yes, we got the hop gun. They did a great marketing strategy, whatever is the company that sold it. And now I see a lot of these hop gun, you know, in the corner of the brewery. Yeah, I mean, that's the first one that came out. But then, you know, now everyone has a hop gun in their manufacturer. And now there is literally a coat hanger, a very expensive coat hanger. And you ask brewers, like, why are you not using anymore your hop gun? Like, well, you know, it needs to circulate for such a long time to actually get the extraction. And the extraction is not that powerful as we want it to. Or some of the times, you know, these devices have a maximum capacity, which can be, I don't know, 20, 30 kilos, depends how big it is. And if you want to make a different beer that maybe has more hops in it, then you need to do more round. And that takes maybe 4 or 5 hours, depending how big is your tank. Yeah, and then you need to CAP it, so you need to clean it. And this is dead leg central. So there are many places that needs to be cleaned by hand or, you know, creating loops. So it's not something super easy. It's very time consuming. And, you know, in a brewery, what we actually need, it's more time, which we don't have because there are so many things happening at the same time. But there are even some pros. Like we had it in the brewery in the stadium. So Beaverton had a brewery in the Tottenham Stadium. And somehow we happened to have one of those. And the first thing we did, it was taking off the candle filter. And the candle filter. It depends. Depends how clean is your beer once you're doing it. Because if it gets covered in yeast, then, you know, you struggle to go through and then that's when it gets blocked. Mm-hmm. Or if you have proteins, you know, depends how dirty is your beer. But which usually, if it's mid-fermentation or the end of fermentation, it's going to be fairly dirty. So most likely it's going to block. So what we did, we took the candle filter off and we just used it as an external tank. So we add the hops, we purged it, and then just with pressure, we move the beer into the hop can, bump up the pressure and send it back in, did 2-3 times back and forth. It was a 10 minutes job, it was really fun. As a brewer, I always love to play with pressure and just slam things back and forth into a tank. I think it's quite satisfying. And then we have the hop dosing vessel. So this is not a common thing. And it was designed specifically for Beaverwort, so the new brewery of Beavertown. And when we saw it, we were like, this is revolutionary. Like, it's amazing. Great extraction. It's super fast, easy to clean. And you can, you know, it shortens your dry hopping time by a long time. But how it works. So imagine an external tank with almost a flat bottom, almost, with like a mixer in the bottom. So which three buckets with a hole in the bottom. So it wasn't creating a wave, but it was just going through. So what you were doing, you were adding the hops in, purging, and then you were collecting the beer from a higher port from your tank. In that way, you weren't touching the yeast in the bottom. So you were doing a yeast off, you were doing an harvest, but of course, you can't take it all out, otherwise increase your losses and everything, so you just take what you need. So you were collecting the beer from the top going into the hop dosing vessel, and then you were mixing it for 10, 15 minutes, and then just send it back, always from the top. So contact time, super short, but the surface of contact, huge, because you were literally infusing for very high speed for 10, 15 minutes, and then send it back. And that allowed you to do dry hopping. As soon as we were moving back into the tank, we were setting the chiller to go down to zero in 24 hours. And the extraction was insane. And we reduced all the hop flavors as well. You know, sometimes you get that interaction between yeast and hops. You might get mercaptan out of it. This was like game changer. Static. Many breweries, especially if you have small tanks, I think if you have a 20, 30 hectares tank, you probably don't need any external device to do a dry hopping. And you can just climb it safely. Safely. And you can pull your hops from the top. But, you know, it's not just, I'm adding the hops from the top and I hope for the best. There are actually techniques that can give you like a lot out of it. So you can get lots of extraction, lots of flavor, and not that, you know, one off flavors from it. So, and I mean, it's the cheapest way of doing a dry hopping because like a hop gun, I don't know how much it costs, but you can do a few dry hopping with it. So static dry hopping, I think can be divided in two sections. So with these days we see, you know, what was the trend. So we got a lot of AZ beers. So you need to do a dry hopping early in order to get that polyphenol yeast bind. And so that's called, you know, high krausen. So it's when it's the peak of the fermentation. And brewers do that, you know, to hit biotransformation. And it happens usually between 24 to 48 hours from cast out. Depends if your yeast is dry, if it's a wet yeast. What's important, something to not forget, is always to do a trub off. Because, yeah, fermentation starts, but the protein, as soon as you do the cast out, imagine the tank is a little bit cold, so there is the protein break, and they always go into the bottom of the tank. And I think it's something that not all the brewers do. They sometimes forget, because it's not much. It's sometimes on a 10 hectos is 200 milliliters. So you're like, ah, is it going to make a difference? Yes, it does. Because it keeps your beer much cleaner. You got less protein. And then your dry hopping, like the result, I think it's nicer. And a more classic one is an end of fermentation one. And here I wrote like a little standard operation procedure for it, which we tested in years in Beavertown, even before when I was at Red Church. We were contracting for Beavertown and we had very strict like a SOP to follow. And I would start with, you know, a VDK test at the end of fermentation just to see if I have any diacetyl. Not that it will stop me from doing dry hopping or not, just at least I know they already have it there. Maybe I want to add some ALDC or maybe not. Maybe I have more time so I can let it reabsorb. Then I drop the temperature of the tank 24 hours earlier. Usually, if you're fermenting an IPA around, you know, 20, 21 degrees, I would drop it to 18. Why that? 18 is enough to get most of the yeast dropping in the bottom of the cone for two reasons. One is if you are harvesting your yeast, you are using it, like that's a great way of getting it down without stopping the fermentation at the end. And second, like it cleans up your beer. Like when you do a dry hopping in the fermentation, you're not looking for that interaction of yeast and hops. You want to do something that it's clean and you want the flavor of the hops to come out and you don't want to have, you don't want the yeast to interfere with it. So then, of course, you add your hops and then the hops start falling down. But then you imagine this pellet. I always imagine, you know, the T90 into the tank going down, 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 sinking. And then you're like, yeah, how long is it going to take for this to start dissolving? And what's the contact, you know, the surface of contact? And I kind of get worried for them. I'm like, yeah, I just put, I don't know, 1,000 pound worth of hops in it, and they're just sitting in the bottom. So that's, again, why it's good to take the yeast out, because then you can rouse it gently from the bottom and creating this agitation and trying to, you know, increase the surface of contact and get them, you know. What we used to do was two times, so it was 48 hours dry hopping, two times a day, gentle bubbling. Like, don't have to slam it, but just keep it up nice and gentle. And then at the end, of course, you do another VDK because you might have a little bit of a hop creep, you don't know. And then, you know, once that passed, you can chill it. So here we do a little recap of, I know it's a lot of information, a lot of like how this works without actually seeing it working in real life. So it can be difficult to figure it out. So here is a little recap of all the four ways that I explained before of doing dry hopping. So we got the top addition, simple, fast, cheap, doesn't cost you, you know, extra money for it. Potential risk of higher DO pickup. Why? Because you're opening the tank and it's the end of fermentation. And so you might get some oxygen in. You know, there is this, you mean the cone on top and just...
On top that you can pressurize?
Yeah. But then depends, you know, do you have the space on top to actually have it?
Because usually who builds breweries, they want to maximize the space they have, so they put this very close to the roof and so... But,
yeah, you could avoid big DO by having little cone that you could...
Yeah, of course, yeah. But if you are just opening it, like, of course, it's the end of fermentation, so there's not much happening. As a brewer, we always, you know, hope that the CO2 blanket will save us from anything. The CO2 blanket, yes, but it's a little bit of a myth sometimes. But, of course, if you know that it's the end of fermentation, you can always do a little bubbling while you're doing dry hopping and let the CO2 coming up. Or if you're, you know, playing with CO2, it can be dangerous, especially if you are at height. So what I would recommend for this is adding your hops and then connecting your carbon stone or do a gentle bubbling with a side arm open. And as soon as you can smell a little bit of CO2, or maybe you have an Huffman or a C-box that you want to check the headspace, and then you shut it. And you know that the whole headspace is saturated with CO2, and that's a good way of minimizing DO pickup. Optosing vessel, I love it. I know it's something quite unique. You would have to get it designed. I don't know if it's commercially available for everyone. But the good thing is that higher surface of contact, because you're literally mixing it. Faster extraction, 24 hours, it's plenty. Minimal DO pickup. Closed container, you purge it and you check that it's completely purged. And so it's all a closed loop, so there is no oxygen there. Hop gun, and you might have, you know, the feeling of it, I don't like it. Why? Because it's slower. You need to recirculate for like X amount of time, the volume of your tank. Personally, I don't like to circulate my beer through the pump for like a long period of time, because I always imagine the beer as this, you know, lots of molecules holding their hands. And if you keep on whacking them through the pump, that's not going to do good for the flavor and for the product.
So sharing a funny story, I did an internship in a Norwegian brewery, I'm not saying the name. They had a hop gun, and basically they would prefer to dry up by transferring beer from one tank to the other by putting the hops in the second tank. Mm-hmm. You know, like the beer was in FB1,
yeah.
And they were transferring on to the FB2 to already full of hops. So the dry upping will be by transferring the beer to like FB. And they was refusing to use the hop gun. He was just like sending like and clutter. This is nuts. Yeah. It's like, I don't know, 80,000 euro in there. Just
I'm not using for him.
It's a very expensive hand-cut device. Yeah, I agree.
For cocoa leaves extraction. That was the only use they were doing for him.
I think I know who you're talking about, but I'm not going to say it. Again, risk of blocking. As we said, your beer can be dirty. It can be coating the candle filter with yeast or proteins. On the other hand, minimal DO pickup, because if everything is tight, it's a closed container, it's purged, so you should be able to avoid any DO from it. Last one, Hopnik. So Hopnik, I have mixed feeling about it, because I do like it, it's functional, it's quick, you can CAP it very nicely, and it grinds the hops, so you have, you know, very high surface of contact. You can recirc. This 30 minutes recirculation is for a 120 hectos tank. So if you have a smaller tank, probably less, but it's all a matter of, you know, trial and error and see what works for your geometry of your tank and everything. Minimal DO pickup, closed container again. What's the problem with this? Is the yeast stress. Because, okay, you need to make sure that you need to yeast off properly your tank, but there's always going to be some. And as the hops go through the macerator and they get grinded, same happens for the yeast. So all the cells that goes through for 30 minutes at, you know, 60 rounds per minute, like, you know, it's a lot of stress. So you might then have some yeast stress or flavor, some mercaptan, some H2S. Then H2S, you can strip it with CO2, but that's not selective. We were talking about it yesterday. So you strip the good and the bad. Mercaptan, you can't strip it. So it's there. And you might not smell it while your beer is nice and cold, but as soon as it warms up, is that bean juice kind of smell that I can't stand it personally. Some people like it because they associate it to dankness. But to me, after doing the Aroxa training, it scarred me for life. I'm like, oh no, I can't smell it anymore.
Your favorite?
Favorite device? Yeah. Look, if I was building my own brewery tomorrow and had some extra cash, I would probably try to commission like a hop dosing vessel. So for me, hop dosing vessel first, and second is the Hopnik, and third is the hop gun, but I don't even put it into my chart. But ultimately, like, I saw great result from dry hopping from the top as well. Like, that's an interesting story, actually. When we were contracting Necoil at Red Church, we were dry hopping from the top because we didn't have an Hopnik. And Beavertown actually had an Hopnik. And our beers were scoring higher than theirs. And we were having like more extraction and the flavor was really, really nice. And we were just doing, you know, the yeast off, hops on the top, bubbling 2 days, chill it. So I don't think you really need a dry hopping device. It all depends, you know, what's your tank schedule, you know, how many people you got working on the floor. You know, every brewery is different, so it's very hard to say this is best. Like, I think everyone has his own setup, and maybe somebody could benefit from one or the other, or maybe just keep dropping from the top. Do you have a favorite one?
I
at BV, I was enjoying a lot the flavors from Dobnik. But to be very honest, I brewed it as well, a little bit beer from Stop Edition. That sometimes I was having like layers of aroma that I was not adding with Aquit, for example. So I think it really depends up in the matrix is quite wide of white is one way or the other. But Opnik, I think from a safety perspective and like Knox putting DO and, you know, I was very happy. I never used the opposing vessel at all. Opgun, I tried a few times. It's not that neat.
And I regretted it. So, this is an interesting graph. So, you were saying in the beginning, leaving the hops into your tank for 4 or 5 days, from a logic perspective, makes you think, yes, I'm going to get more out of it. In brewing, of course, it's not like that. And this is one of the reasons. So your hop flavor, like your aroma compounds, your chemical compounds, they have a peak time. And then they start decreasing. Sometimes because it's volatile, some other times because it gets reabsorbed into the green matter, right? So you're thinking, I'm tasting this beer day two, and I'm like, wow, this is amazing. Like, I'm going to leave it one more day because I want a little bit more of it. It's like gambling. The day after, you're tasting it, like, where is it gone? Like, yesterday was much better. That's the reason. So we got the myrcene. Myrcene is one of the highest compounds into the hops. So it peaks at 44 hours. And it degrades after 72 hours. So 48 hours dry hopping, you're still in the peak. So you want to make sure that then you chill and then you start taking all the stuff out and you try to go into packaging as soon as possible to actually preserve that flavor. As brewers, we know that, you know, drinking beers from the tank is unbeatable. And once you put it into the can or into the kegs, it will never taste as good as it was in the tank. But having this in mind actually helps you like think a little bit ahead. I mean, like probably, you know, we shouldn't leave this beer in tank for too long. We should go into packaging. We should finish the dry hopping quicker and so on. With the linalool is another good one. Here we have two options. So static, it peaks at 72 hours. And agitated, so if you're doing some circulation of sort, peaks at 4 hours, and then it drops by 24 hours. Of course, you know, agitation is fast, but makes it more volatile. Linalool is much more volatile than myrcene. And of course, the two things, they don't match the time together, because if I'm waiting 72 hours for the linalool, I'm already down from the peak time of myrcene. So you do need to find your sweet spot. And at the same time, if you're doing a early dry hopping, maybe go on the myrcene, but if you're doing a late one, go on the linalool, or vice versa, you know, build layers and trying to use different hops that have different content level of these two or any other, you know, there are geraniol, so many other chemical compounds in it that you might look for in a beer. And so reading that certificate of analysis we were talking yesterday, that's really important because it makes you understand probably this hop is better if I use it in the whirlpool. This one is better if I use it into the end of fermentation. Because of this reason, because the flavor peaks and then it starts dropping. And we all want to drink our beers when it's at peak. Now we go into something that I really care about it. Because we experienced, all of us, you know, the madness of 2017 onwards of like more hops, 20 grams a liter, 30 grams a liter. That's insane. Exactly. I find that insane. And when I was in California for my 30th, I went to visit Stone Brewing. And I was asking to the head of innovation, I was like, you know, they're famous for their hoppy beer. I was like, Chris, I'm like, how much is too much? They were like, well, we did trials. And for us, anything over 9 grams a liter, like you're literally throwing money down the drain. And that stuck with me. And we did trial as well. You know, then there are loads of scientific articles that says that the threshold, the plateau, it's 8 grams a liter. because anything more than that, I mean, you can't tell the difference between an 8 gram a liter IPA and a 15 grams a liter IPA. The only difference is how much it's costing you and how much loss you have. So I understand for marketing reasons, sometimes people get excited about it. Like, oh my God, that's 30 grams a liter. It's going to be banging. And so people buy it. But over 8 grams a liter, like, you're not getting more. It's just adding cost. And so why doing it? And maybe if you want to add more hops, is something good to think about it. It's like when to add them. So not all in the dry hopping, but I start building layers in the hot side and building the substrate if I want to try to get some early biotransformation. But I start building layers. And then maybe the final bill is 20 grams a liter, but it's not just in the dry hopping.
Like mash hopping?
Yeah. So mash hopping, I really like it because you get all the aroma without the bitterness, because of course you're mashing at lower temperature than when you're boiling it. And at that temperature, you actually get out more terpenoids, which are all the good flavor. That's why even first wort addition is great, because when you are lautering into your kettle, you're usually around 70 degrees. And 70 degrees is the right temperature to get the terpenoids out of it. And then after 45 minutes, I mean, your lautering lasts more than 45 minutes, all your alpha are isomerized, so you're not pulling any more bitterness. And you get all that nice aroma that it's something that stays in your mouth and it's not something that you smell. But I think it's a nice flavor. Have you ever done it? Or?
We did a couple of bands and we really liked it. We're trying this... the multi-doy work times. So when we tried to do the first time, he said he thought it was a waste of hop usage. And then we just showed them in examples of other breweries here doing mash hopping, and it's like, this beer is great. So we tried it a couple times, and the beers were...
Because it also helps for biotransformation.
Yeah, it depends if you're using hops that are contain thiols and stuff like that. That's great if you want to do mash hopping with it.
Yeah, sure. I did a few times, but I would always use it more for like lager-like beers.
Like, but I was doing it more like for the kind of these very nice lingering bitterness that I'm adding an extra layer, and then I started to deep dive a bit into it. Like, this actually makes more sense than just like a feeling that the beer tastes better, you know, like, because you start to learn a bit about tiles, terpene, then your triggers for biotransformation. Like, okay, this makes total sense. And now, or I'll be more up for beers.
Yeah,
I think it also makes total sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you have whole leaf hops, it's great because it helps the filtration as well of your lauter. And it's easier, like it doesn't compact like the T90 pellets. And I remember when I moved to the UK, I moved to this brewery up in Manchester, and I never used whole leaf hops because in Italy it wasn't a thing. And I had so much of it. There were so many boxes of it. And at some point I was like, I need to use this stuff. It's, you know, getting old. And I started adding it everywhere. So mash hopping in the middle of the lautering, first wort, and everywhere, because you can't do a dry hopping with it. So you need to use them a lot in the hot side. You start experimenting, and I found that, you know, the filtration of the lautering was actually going better with lots of whole leaf hops. This is something really that I care about, and I speak a lot with lots of brewers. And you know, we want to maximize, so we want to get as much as possible out of our hops. But I think something really important is to learn how not to waste. Because if you start learning about, you know, how to not waste your product, you're already maximizing. You're already winning there. And here there are, you know, a few examples of things that you can do to try and maximize your hop aroma without wasting. And one of it, you know, water profile. This is always a difficult one because some brewers really get it and some other don't. That's pure chemistry. Like, it can be quite daunting. But they say the general message here is, calcium sulfate, of course, is going to push your hop aroma being a little bit more forward. Of course, you don't want something completely out of balance. We're talking, you know, 2-to-1. And as I say, you know, keep an eye on bitterness, because if you go too much on the calcium sulfate, you will get, you know, you can get a little bit of a harsh bitterness. That's why you need to counterbalance it with some calcium chloride that brings a little more roundness and so on. Higher ABV, they work very well. So more ethanol, more extraction. Like sometimes, I don't know if you ever tried a version of a session IPA made into a double IPA. Like usually you use a little bit less hops because you get more extraction out of it. It's more powerful. And that's because the ethanol works as a solvent for hop oils. This connects to the, you know, trend of the non-alc beer. That's why it's so difficult to actually get that flavor out of the hop, because there is no alcohol that, you know, helps this transformation. When building your flavor profile, always think in layers. So imagine opening, like putting a can, you know, you want to smell it, you want to taste the flavor, and you want that the flavor stays in your tongue for a little bit and then calls for the next sip. This happens, is possible only if you're building in layers. Because if you just put, you know, the hops only in the whirlpool, that's it, it's going to be monotone. Or only one variety, it's going to be monotone. So you need to be able to build layers even when you're using, you know, one hop, only one hop across the whole brew. How do you do that? You add in it in different step with different technique, trying to get different result from the same product. I find that dry hopping between 18 and 22 degrees, like, is great for extraction. And I'm very sensitive to ester compounds, so I don't like to go with the fermentation over the 22 degrees. And I rather ferment a little bit colder, around, you know, 19 degrees, and do the dry hopping in that window there. Like, we notice that, you know, you get the most extraction without all the off flavors that can come from the yeast and ester compounds. Blend the type of hops to reach different depth of flavor. So these days we are seeing a lot of liquid hops, extract, T90, T45, cryogenic, Lupomax. There are so many. Like, when you look at them, you're like, okay, which one do I pick? And they're all different in their own way, and they all do different things. I do believe that T90 is always going to be a good baseline to start with. And then you can start adding maybe some cryogenic or some Lupomax if you want to start reducing your hop bill and increase your yield and save on some losses. Or maybe you want to add a little bit of those liquid hops. But always blend it together. Like, I find some brewers, of course, it's curiosity and you want to see what happened. And you just buy all these liquid hops and you're like, okay, cool. I got Simcoe, Mosaic and Citra. Ploof, ploof, let's see what happened. It's just too much. Like, it's just a perfume. And you want to have that flavor, that depth. And that's why, for instance, the BBC from Bartas, I think, is a great product. Because you have, it's lupulin enriched, but you have the green matter that you have in a T90. So it actually gives you more, but still with a good balance and well-rounded aroma. So I really like it. If you like to dry hop early, so focus on variety with high myrcene, for the reason we were talking before, for the peak time. And that's why having a hop certificate of analysis, it's so important, not just because you're reading the alpha acids percentage, and so you know how much bitterness you're going to have, but because it tells you so much more. It tells you all the hop oil, all the oil compounds, the chemistry behind, the percentage, the moisture. It gives you so much information that can actually guide you on the choice of dry hopping method or dry hopping time and so on. Optimal contact time. So this is really interesting. Like, I wrote an article for the Brewers Journal, and Garrett from Boston Beer Company? Brooklyn, yeah. He commented this, saying, oh, but what about hop creep? And I mean, this guy commenting on my article was flattering. And at the same time, like, it's something that you can have an argument about this easily. And what I learned and what I from my academic studies and what I learned on the brewery floor is that 48 hours on a static dry hopping, I think that should be the max. You shouldn't go any farther. And if you have a agitation, probably you should reduce the time. And why? Because longer, you just pull more polyphenols, more, you know, grassy vegetable taste and flavor. You don't really want that in your beer. And but then you're like, 48 hours, that sounds, you know, very little. Like, lots of things can happen in 48 hours. So what about hop grape? So hop grape is a fermentation that is unintentional. So you're not looking for it. And sometimes when that happens, your beer is already in can, and then you have cans that are exploding, diacetyl comes back. So the acetal in this is the last of my concern, because, you know, these days you can add ALDC if you're feeling, you know, nervous about it. And that's not a problem. But if your fermentation keeps going, then you have, you know, higher ABV, higher carbonation, cans are popping. If you have a contract with the supermarket, they're not gonna be happy about it. So I think keeping your fermentation under control and being able to be consistent with your pitching rate helps you to be in control of this, because it can happen. You know, we know that in hops there is some, you know, some residual sugar, and maybe you have a little bit of yeast in suspension, a little bit too much. It can happen. So good practice is standardize your yeast pitching, standardize your fermentation, and make sure that when you dry hopping at the end of fermentation, there is not much yeast in suspension. The temperature is a little bit lower, and in this way, you can mitigate Omer coming into your life like a creep.
But then when you say 48 hours max, okay, imagine you're doing a
static dry hopping. By saying that 48 hours max contact time, you mean that you should centrifuge it, you should purge it?
You can just chill the tank. Just chill it. You know, usually with the way I'm doing it, I'm taking down to -1.5. Yeah. And that depends how strong is your chiller. So where I used to work, like in 6-8 hours, it was going down. So you already account for that. So I start chilling the tank 6 hours before the 48 hours mark.
Then I ask you, what about though?
Sorry?
Then I ask you, what about though?
Exactly. And then, you know, once it's chilled, then you can centrifuge it or add finings or, you know, whatever is your, you know, procedure into your brewery. Yeah, I already spoiled this. Sorry. I forgot I had this. So hop creep measures. So little recap, collect as much yeast as possible before dry hopping. And you don't want that interaction at the end of the fermentation. And probably you should repeat your yeast and save some money to your brewery. Dry hop contact time below 48 hours. How many of you do, like, on a few batches every now and then, a forced fermentation just to see, you know, how it ends, how it will end?
I do sometimes when I have time. And when I, especially, I should do it in our core beer, but once in a while, when we're doing one-off, so I try to do like the when we are uncertain when it's gonna end or it's ended already. I just do like a first fermentation to see like if it's ready to go up. It has still sugar second ferment.
I think it's something that should happen on a regular basis into a brewery, especially when you're changing maybe your malt batches, so the, you know, the COA changed. And it's something interesting to see. So you're already prepared for it. And it helps even, you know, standardize your fermentation, because you know that that's where it's going to end. And then you can adjust your fermentation profile in order to, you know, maybe shave some days here and there if that's what you need. Or, you know, just optimize your dry hopping time. Maybe you're trying to optimize your fermentation in order to not have to go on Sunday and dry hop your beer on Sunday. So it can actually happen on Monday and it's the right time for it. We are at the end of this presentation. I talk about hops a lot. Like I start writing an educational email on the first Monday of January. And I said, I will try and stay consistent and write every week, every Monday, 8 a.m. sharp, an educational email about hops. There's been times where I thought, oh my God, I don't know what to talk about it. Like hops. And like you're thinking, oh, hop grape, done it. Biotransformation, done it. like, what can I talk about it? And actually, there's always something to talk about it. And that's amazing. That's the beauty of ops, in my opinion. So if you want to stay up to date, that's the QR code where you can sign up to the educational email and just follow Monday by Monday what's the, you know, the developing of this hop knowledge. And yes, that's it. If you have any question, guys, please go ahead.
I do. Maybe it's a topic for next up to date. A question by email. Do you have any takes on reusing a dry hop?
What was my last beer?
So I know a brewer that does it. So do you mean using dry hopping into the hot side?
Both.
Okay.
Like, for example, I've done it before, but it's not very scientifically proven, or I didn't deep dive into it, but I already took beer from a dry hop to put in a late edition in a boil or whirlpool. I never did for dry hopping. I know people who did to put it in another tank and then rack it to get still some extraction from it.
But I would like to get your take on it.
Yeah, so from a scientific point of view, we know that when you do dry hopping and then you're dumping it, there is so much left to it and it feels like a waste to actually not use it. I know a brewery in London that reuse it into the hot side, which is great. You know, you're saving on the planet, on the environment, the money and everything. But how can you be consistent with your IBUs? Because, yeah, you're drying it. And then how are you checking the alphas that are left in it? So how can you standardize your process? So if you are a small brewery, I don't know, and you sell everything in your tap room and, you know, you can name things in a very creative way, why not? Let's try and see what happens. If you are a big brewery, you're going to supermarket and your, you know, customer are used to that taste and so on, it's very hard to be consistent with it. The answer to it, if you really want to do it, be ready to start doing some blending. Because then you make everything, you know, quite the same. And, you know, blending always covers a lot of mistakes, and that's actually pretty useful. Reusing it for another dry hopping, I never tried it myself. I would be a little bit scared about it, mainly for contamination. But, I mean, I can't see why not. I mean...
So you dry hop it first, and so you take all the good things about the hops. And you bring another beer with, like, obviously it's still some stuff, but aren't the best stuff out already?
I mean, it's hard to say. I didn't read.
They're doing something that is not, maybe not very hop forward or something like that. You can handle.
I'm just thinking that maybe you have another beer that is not saturated with hops yet, so he's still going to extract sun from the blood from the same up, so you're not over saturating with some sort of polyphenol content, for example. And you might still have some oil content that I'm just brainstorming.
Yeah, I think it makes sense from a, you know.
I know there's a brewing in Netherlands, Rock City. They do like some sort of like, they do this approach, they call it second hand or something like that. It's something similar, like, and they do it. And I tried it and I find it very surprising. And they really say they are using it for dry hopping as well. Like, they are using the leftover of dry hopping from the first year. And then they brew the same version of this beer, but they give it a different label. And they are using the hops from the first beer to dry up a second.
Oh, hell. Yeah, like second-hand IPA. Yeah, absolutely. I'm all for it. Yes, guys, I hope you enjoyed it and you're coming out from here with a little bit of knowledge and maybe something to put in practice in your brewery.
I think it's a very good presentation. Yes.
Thank you.
Really, really good. Thank you.
Thank you. It's my first ever presentation, so lucky.
We are just easy. Yes. No, it's really good.
Awesome. Yeah, I will share this with you. So you guys, if you want to have a look at it or if you have some viewers that could be interested in it, you can read it in their free time.
I can share with my colleagues as well.
But what I find very funny and we were commenting is yesterday is like, it's funny that we are having these kind of educational talks and, you know, like the brewers that are here are mainly two breweries that already have the standards a bit higher for the Portuguese scene, and the ones that are not, they are not interested in learning. So I find it funny.
That's when we need to send them a nice DVD, this presentation. Can't escape this.
Because then they will never come, you know, like, see, you send them in our room.
Yeah.
What PV is play?
See.
Yeah. Teach.
Thank you so much, Master.
Awesome. Thank you guys for coming. Thank you.
Espero que tenhas gostado deste episódio e que tenhas aprendido algo novo sobre o fascinante equilíbrio entre técnica e criatividade no mundo de lúpulo. E se queres continuar a aprofundar o teu conhecimento sobre cerveja artesanal, dos processos à prova, passando pelas escolas e estilos, visita beerexpert.pt. Curso criado por David Santos e por mim, pensado para quem quer dominar o universo da cerveja, de forma prática e acessível. Como sempre, se gostaste deste episódio, deixa uma avaliação de 5 estrelas na tua plataforma de podcasts e segue este podcast para não perderes os próximos episódios. E por último, se achares que este episódio pode ser útil para alguém, envia-o e eu agradeço por isso. E se não for antes, vemo-nos na próxima cerveja.